So Rashi, in the beginning of Parshas Shemini, Vayi Bayom HaShemini, was on the eighth day, Kara Moshe La'aron Ulevana, Moshe called out to Aaron and his sons, Lezikne Yisrael, to the elders of Yisrael. Says Rashi, Vayi Bayom HaShemini, Shemini LaMiluin. It was the eighth day of the Miluin, right? Hu Rosh Chodesh Nisan, it was the first day of Nisan, Shehukam HaMishkan, Bo Bayom. They set up the Mishkan on that day. Venatol Eser Atarus HaShemiyos B'Seder Olam, they took 10 crowns that are learned in Seder Olam. There were 10 crowns that were given on that day. So it doesn't say in Rashi what those 10 crowns are, but it does say in Seder Olam, and it does say in the Midrash Rabbah what those 10 crowns are. And one of them is called Rishon Lebriya Sa'olam. It's the first of the creation of the world. Now, I don't know if anybody's been checking, but the first day of the Mishkan was not the first day of the world. In case anybody's been paying attention since Parshas Bereishis up until now, there's been a couple Parshas up until now, but it's not the first day of the world. So everybody translates that as Rishon Lebriya Sa'olam means what day? What day are we talking about?
I don't know. Sunday.
We're talking about Sunday. Sunday, right? But what's the big deal? Who cares that it's Sunday? Wouldn't it be cooler if it was Shabbos? Like, to have it be on a holy day rather than just be on a regular Sunday? It's a Sunday. It's not that big of a deal, but the fact that it's the first day of the week or anything like that. So what's the deal? So the answer is, it's answered by the Moscow Ladov. It's an easy answer, but it's a cute little answer that you get for Shabbos, that the Zohar says that Bria Sa'oma, that the entire creation of the world was Tali Va'ome. It was waiting. It was hanging in the balance, waiting for them to build up the Mishkan. I know we say that about Yom HaShishi, that the whole world was Tali Va'omed for the Torah to be given on Har Sinai. And I know we said this all, we're going to say this later on also, that it's Tali Va'omed, there's going to be Tali Va'omed regarding the Chazir. There's other Tali Va'omeds in the world, but the world was Tali Va'omed to see what would happen if they would create the Mishkan. Once they made the Mishkan, says the Zohar, then it became Miskayim. Say it was like weakened beforehand, and now it was Miskayim. Now it's stronger, because now they can really have a permanent place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be able to rest in Shechina. There's perfect things for them to have over there. And thus, this is the first day in this new world that's now a strong world. It was a weak world, now it became a strong world. It was Rishon Lebriya Sa'olam, now it's the real Rishon. Now it really became the first Sunday that was around there. It's a strong Sunday. And that's the pshat in the Gemara Megillah, when the Gemara Megillah combines the two. It says, Vayihi Bayom HaShemini is a good day, just like Vayera Vayivoker Yom HaRishon. Yom Rishon. There's the first day. Yom Echad. I said Rishon, didn't I? Yeah, that's the whole part why it's not called Rishon. Yom Echad. It was evening and morning. It was the first day. The connection between the two is what? The connection is easy now. It only became a Yom Echad. It only became a Sunday, a real Sunday, once the Mishkan was really set up. Once the Mishkan was set up, then everything was really made. Then it was all set up. And that's also the reason why it's called Rishon Lechadashim. What do you mean the first of the Chadashim? Nisan was last year. You had a Nisan last year, and they were freed last year, you're right, but this is the first year that they had a full Nisan as Jews, a full Nisan as real Jews standing with the Torah, having everything. It's the first Nisan like that, so it's Rishon Lechadashim, it's a Rishon Lebriya Sa'olam, it's the first for all these things. It's the first time they've been together. Okay, so that's just a little cue for so you can say something over at the Shabbos table. You can fulfill your chiyuv and be like, you know, like Patrasan mi lomar, instead of saying Patrasan mi lomar manishtana, you know, Patrasan mi lomar vort at the Shabbos table. Well, that's good enough. Okay, now let's get into the really cool stuff. I don't think you're going to be able to say most of this, but none of it of you passed away in this parsha. There's a lot of stuff leading up to it, a lot of tremendous things leading up to it. I'm not going to necessarily go into it. Like the little, if you guys want to look up the little things involved over here, there's Krav El Mizbeach, Krav El Mizbeach Ve'aseh in Pasuk Zayin. That Krav happens to have, if you look in the Torah, I didn't lame this week, but if you look in the Torah on this Pasuk and Krav, there's two extra tagin, which means two extra crowns written on the top of the kuf. Some say it's on the Reish, it's on the Kuf of the Reish, on the Krav. And the question is, why does it have those tagin? They said that Aaron looked at the Mizbeach and saw the horns of the Ego Azov sticking out from the Mizbeach and got scared out of his mind, and he didn't want to be mocker of any Korban. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to call to him and say, let's go, let's bring it on, you know? Like, take it on. It doesn't make a difference, you'll be able to go up there. Krav El Mizbeach Va'aseh. We're going to skip all that for now. Vayichu b'nei Aaron Nadav v'aviyu ish machtaso. B'nei Aaron Nadav v'aviyu took each man his pan. Vayinu b'hein ish, they put a fire in it. Vayisivu la ketores, and they placed the ketores, the sweet-smelling spices, incense, whatever you want to call it, on top of that thing. Vayakrivu v'nei Hashem, they brought it in front of God. Ish zara, a strange fire. Not for that word, zara. I would be able to tell you the absolute greatest word you'll ever hear in your world. I wouldn't want to tell it to you, because I think you'd all pass out. It could be that you'd all need to clear some mason afterward. It would be a massive, massive problem. I don't want to tell you, but it doesn't say, it says the word Zara, so it's not the best word of all time. Actually, look, Tivo, some that he had not commanded them to do. A fire came out from in front of God, and it consumed them, and they died in front of God. This is what God meant when he said, I'm going to become holy through my relatives. And I'll be honored by all the in front of all the people. And Aaron was?
Son.
Oh, the silence. That's all we've got there. Don't worry, come in here. So either way, Vayidom Aaron, he was silent. What's going on over here? Oh, such a thing to be able to have Nadav and Aviv complete. All right, were they good people or were they bad people? Were they good people or bad people?
I don't know.
Awful.
Awfully good people.
Awfully good people. That's a good change turnaround. Wow, that was a nice turnaround over there. There seems to be from Rashi. Rashi says over here that Amalei Moshe La'aron. Moshe said to Aaron, Aaron, Achi, my brother, Yodea Yisishi, Skadish Abayis Bim Yodov Shal Makom. I knew that the house was going to be consecrated, the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan was going to be consecrated with the death of somebody big. And I thought it was either me or you. Now I see that they're greater than me and you. Wow. Now, the Chanuk Satorah makes a bunch of diukim in this Rashi. It comes out that none of you were greater than Aaron and Moshe combined. That's a tremendous level. I don't know if anybody knows how great Moshe and Aaron really were. But to put them on the level and just be like, for none of you to be greater. And this is not one of those lines where like I'm eulogizing the person. I'm saying like, oh, he's the greatest person ever. And the guy was like a nobody. This is not one of those times. It wouldn't have made it in the Torah, and it wouldn't have made Rashi if that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. It's just like lying to him. And it's just like, yeah, they were great guys. They did something really dumb. It can't be. So what happened over here? Yeah.
But aren't there opinions that say that at Har Sinai they stare?
Oh. Yes. Yes.
Right, wait. And that's when the old,
wait.
When will these old people
I got
die?
A little bit of a I got a little bit of a strange thing over here. Asher Lotziva Osam. Osam over here is written without a vav. Happens to be the Baal HaTorim mentions this. The notes of the Baal HaTorim ask seven different places that are not like this. But he says, the Baal HaTorim says Osam is only written with a vav twice in the Torah. Now, the Baal HaTorim's notes asks, there are other places where it's written with a vav. He tries answering whatever. But it does say in the pasuk before, Asher Lotziva Osam, there's no vav in the word Osam. The next pasuk, I take to Hashem, listen to Hashem, but Tochal Osam, it consumed them. There is a vav. Baal HaTorim says, what's the vav doing there? He says, because there were six major sins that Nadav and Aviv did on that day. What were those six sins? Number one, Horu Halacha Bifnei Moshe Rabbah. They were Mora Halacha in front of the Rebbe, without asking the Rebbe first. Number two, an Eish Zara. They brought up an Eish Zara, a strange fire in the eyes of God. Number three, they died without children. They never got married. Number four, they were Shtuye Yayin. They had drunk wine. Somebody just asked me, I ran into Yashurun to go look something up. And he said, where did they get the wine from? I'm like, oh, that's funny. It's not wine. Number five. We'll get to that. Number five. They said, now this is a tremendous line. They said when Moshe and Aaron were standing in front of them, Nadav turned to Aviu, or vice versa, I'm not so sure which one says which. Nadav turned to Aviu, or Aviu turned to Nadav and said to him, when will these guys die so that we become leaders? Ouch. Where did that come from? How in the world could they have said that? And number six, Lo Nahu Eitzah. They never took advice from Moshe Rabbeinu or Aaron what to do with their lives. They never took advice from other people. They always thought that they were holier than thou to be above everybody else. They never had to take advice. Now, there are other things that are mentioned as part of their demise. For example, as Ellie just said before, they stared at Har Sinai at the Shekhinah. When the Shekhinah came down at Har Sinai, they were able to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They stared at it a little bit too much, a little bit extra, more than what they should have. Also, Aaron did the Egel Azov. And because of Aaron doing the Egel Azov, some of his sons had to be killed. Some of his sons had a Misa, proclamation of death upon them. And also, Moshe said it himself, Bikrovaya Kadesh, somebody was going to die. The greatest person in Klai Yisrael was supposed to die that day. Now that's a strange thing altogether. Why in the world was the greatest person supposed to die? Why was that supposed to be? Where did this all come from? And let's put it all together. Is there a way of combining all these answers and trying to put it into one big thing? So that's why I said, I did combine all of them. The problem was the Ish Zara one. I couldn't get the Ish Zara to go. I had everything except for that one. I worked really hard on it. There was a Chassam Sofer that explained almost everything, and I almost passed out after I read it. Thankfully, I didn't. And then afterward, I was babysitting. It was a problem. And then thankfully, I didn't. Everything worked out in the end, and I didn't get a full answer for it, but it's an awesome, awesome answer. Okay. Kaddish Baruch Hu always wants to be Mekadosh Shmo Barab. He always wants his name to be Mekadosh Barab. He wants everybody to make it holy. He wants everything to work out okay in the best way possible. He always wants to make sure everybody knows he's God, you're not. He's got holy things. You don't have any holy things. If you touch his things, thinking that you can carry the Aron Kodesh, he'll kill you. Like by David HaMelech, when they were trying to bring the Aron Kodesh all the way to Yerushalayim, we know what happened to Uzzah. He tried putting out his hand to save the Aron from falling, and of course he died. Because once he touched the Aron, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, get him out of here. The exact same thing seems to be happening over here. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to show B'nai Yisrael, listen, you want to see how holy my stuff is? I'll show you that nobody can touch my stuff unless they're, even if they're the holiest person that you can imagine, they're still going to die. Moshe Rabbeinu assumes, correctly so, that's going to be either him or Aaron. It's got to be somebody who's on the top of the game. It's got to be the greatest person in all of Klal Yisrael. Because otherwise, it's not a proof. Maybe the guy had a chait. Maybe the guy did something wrong. Maybe there was something wrong with them. Turns out it was Nadav and Aviyu. Why Nadav and Aviyu? Nadav and Aviyu were standing at Har Sinai. We know that there were levels. Moshe Rabbeinu was on the top level. Aaron was on the level below him. Nadav and Aviyu were on the level below Aaron. Under them became the Shivim Zakenim. After them became Elazar and Itamar. You see how far away Elazar and Itamar are from Nadav and Aviyu. Some say that the reason why specifically was because he wanted to make sure that Elazar and Itamar would live and they wouldn't mess up. But Nadav and Aviyu were given the chance to be on the level like Aaron HaTzadik, Aaron HaKohen. They were Kohanim Gedolim in their own right. They had the right to do whatever they wanted when it came to the Mishkan. They were Kohanim Gedolim. They were just like Aaron, on par. I can't say fully on par, but almost equal to Aaron. Especially when they were together. They say they had a soul that combined with one another, and their combined soul was greater than the powers that Aaron had, greater than the neshama that Aaron had. But Nadav and Aviyu had extremely huge powers. When they were at Har Sinai, they saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Shekhinah got him. Just a tiny of the Shekhinah, the Satan got him. Just a tiny little bit. Satan made them look a little bit too long. Made them think to themselves, if we're put on this level, we deserve to look an extra little bit, to go see what the Shekhinah really looks like, to see what the Kisei HaKavod really looks like. So they looked up at the Kisei HaKavod and they stared just a little bit too long. And when they stared for just a little bit too long, all of a sudden, a proclamation of death went out on Nadav and Aviyu, and they were supposed to die. But Hashem refused to allow them to die right then. All the Satan and all his Mashkisim came down, they're ready to kill Nadav and Aviyu on Har Sinai. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, absolutely not, I'm not allowing anyone to die in Har Sinai. It's not going to happen. Says the Be'er Basadeh, the death was pushed off. And when death is pushed off, usually it's perfectly fine. And it was going to be fine. Why? Because you always have schusavos. And because they had a father like Aaron, everything was all good. You got a father like Aaron, you'll be fine. You're not going to be killed. Everything's going to be okay. But in the end, what did Aaron do 40 days later? Egel Azov. That Egel Azov took away the schusavos. And once it took away the schusavos, the proclamation of death came back, and now none of you have to die again. But it was still pushed off a little bit. Why? Because the Egel Azov was bad enough. He didn't want to kill them right there after the Egel Azov, because he was afraid that people would say, why did none of you die? They died because of the Egel Azov. He didn't want anyone to say that, so he pushed it off completely. Then immediately after the Egel Azov, what happened? Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Shemayim, he davened for 40 days, then 80 days, he got the second Luchos, came down, immediately start building the Mishkan. Up until that point, there was no time for them to kill Nadav and Aviyu, because Nadav and Aviyu are supposed to be the Kohanim Gedolim. It would upset the Israel. They would wonder why the Mishkan is happening. Everybody's going to be very upset. Only on this day, the eighth day, when Aaron got his full kapara of the Egel Azov, and that's up shot behind the Krav on his Be'ach Vaseh. What was the first korban that Aaron brought today? On Yom HaShemini? Chatas. What was the Chatas? An Egel. It was an eagle with chazas. He specifically brought the eagle. He looked at the Mizbeach, and what did he see on the Mizbeach? Those horns sticking out of the Mizbeach. He sees that this is the time for his kapara. He sees that there's crazy things that can happen on this day. And he realizes there's something that's going to happen that's going to be beyond anyone's ability. Kaddish Baruch Hu was convinced by the Satan to not allow the fire to go down for just a little bit to see what Bnei Yisrael would do, to see what would happen. None of you were convinced that they knew why the fire wasn't coming down. Moshe Rabbeinu yells at Klal Yisrael. Now this is the only addition that I'm going to add on to all this, because I have a big, big problem with the whole thing about Nadav and Aviyu walking into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Don't you think somebody would have stopped them? I mean, everybody's in the Mishkan. Not only everybody. The Mishkan was a total of 100 by 50 amos. 100 by 50 of the Chatzar Mishkan altogether, not including the actual area that was the Olam Moed itself, where, you know, where the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim was. Not including that area is 100 by 50 amos. For any big mathematicians here, anybody know how many square amos that is?
500.
Yeah. Good. There we go. 5,000 square amos. 5,000 square amos altogether. 5,000 square amos. How many people on Klai Yisrael? We're talking 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, not including the kids, not including the older people, all these people altogether. Everyone was able to fit inside the Chatzar HaMishkan. You see, the Chatzar HaMishkan extended 1,000 times to the amount that it was supposed to be, so that everybody from Klai Yisrael, not the women, unfortunately, not the children, unfortunately, depends on how you look at it, only the men were able to fit inside the Chatzar HaMishkan. Don't worry, they were up in the mountains looking down. So anyway, they had their own answers. Nothing, so it was all good. They're sitting inside the Chatzar HaMishkan. They're all standing inside there. Every single person in Klai Yisrael. You think none of it of you are going to be able to get in without anyone noticing? Without anyone being like, hey, where's Nadav going? You don't think somebody's going to ask the question, where in the world are they going? So I'm making a deek out of a medrash. Moshe Rabbeinu told Bnei Yisrael, it's time to daven. The Eish hasn't come down yet. Let's daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and ask him to bring down the fire. Bring down the Ish. He assumes that that's the reason why the Ish isn't there. Why else wouldn't the Ish come? They have everything set up on the Mizbeach. Everything's ready. Must be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is waiting for Klal Yisrael to daven. So he yells to Klal Yisrael and he says, everybody, let's go and daven right now. Let's daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let's make sure that everything goes straight up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So everybody closed their eyes and davened their silent Shemon Esrei, which was their own pleadings and everything like that. But everybody was davening their own davening. Nadav and Aviyu realized that the reason why the fire wasn't going up is because you have to start it off from a fire down below. A fire only comes from Shemayim when you start a fire from down below. They have to bring an Eish, bring it up onto the Mizbeach, and light the fire, and bring it up on top of that Mizbeach, and make sure that that fire starts, and then the fire can meet them down. They took a Kal V'Chomer from the Nisim, then the Nisim went and brought Ketores on their own, so if the Nisim can bring Ketores on their own, they can bring Ketores on their own, because they're still on the level of Kohen and Gedolim, and they didn't want to tell Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Not because they were Gaivadek, not because of any reason that they didn't want Moshe Rabbeinu to know, because they didn't want to embarrass Moshe Rabbeinu by telling Moshe Rabbeinu, no, the reason why the fire's not here is not because of davening, it's because we haven't started a fire down here for the Ketores yet. Once we start the fire, then everything will work. They made that Kal V'Chomer, and it was a true Kal V'Chomer. The problem is that they were too humble to be able to go up to Moshe Rabbeinu and tell him, listen, this is what we got to do. Too humble to be able to say to him, this is how we have to do it. If we don't do it this way, it's not going to work. So because of that, they went in by themselves, snuck in when everybody was davening, went inside and started the Ketores, started up the Eish. Immediately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepted it. The fire came down from Shemayim, it worked. Everything happened. It was perfectly fine. There was nothing wrong with that. But the fire went into two different strings of fire and entered inside their nostrils, consumed their entire innards of their body, while their outer bodies remained perfectly fine. Completely killed. Killed, but killed only on the inside. Only their neshama was nisra. In Parshas Achrimos, we'll go into what exactly happened with them, what level they're on, and why they had to die in that form, in that fashion, or whatever it is. Why it had to be those two laser beams coming off of Aron Kodesh. Happens to be a very cool way of death. But you have to figure out why in the world it had to happen that way. But we're not going to go into that now. But Nadav and Aviyu went to that level, and they were that. Why is it called Minesh Zara? I don't have a good answer for that. The fact is, it worked, but it wasn't the right time. For some reason, it had to be started from Moshe Rabbeinu's ideas, or Aaron from going in there, not Nadav and Aviyu. That's the reason why it was an Eish Zara. But to answer everything else up, the Eish Zara, fine, I don't have a good answer. Horu Alacha Bifnei Moshe Rabbam is because they were too big of a Nadav to go up to Moshe Rabbeinu and tell him he was wrong. It's not the davening that you need to do, it's this. We got to do this instead. What's the idea of the Shtuya Yayin? Unbelievable Chsam Sofer. They didn't drink wine. What's the reason why you can't drink wine and go into the Beis HaMikdash? Why not? Why? What's intoxicating? What's the problem? It's only Revi'is Yayin, by the way. It's about half of this. You drink this. You can't go and serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Why not? Why not? Because your concentration is not 100% on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Your concentration is not 100% all there. Why? Because you're flying a little bit. You're happy. You're too happy. You're doing something which your body is getting some hanah at the exact same time. The same way that Nadav and Aviyu originally went up on Har Sinai and got a little bit of hanah by looking up at the Shechina, Mida Keneged Mida, the Satan made it that although they didn't think so, when they were going in, they went in thinking, when we light up this fire, that tiny little bit that was in the back of their head said, when we light this fire, everybody's going to look at us and say, Nadav and Aviyu did it. not even Adim did it. They did it. And they're the ones who are going to be the Iker ones. That's the reason why. And aside from that, says the Ksam Sofer, and that's the Shli Yayin, that they had a tiny little bit of drunkenness that was in their head. Enough! That it was enough little tiny bit of gaiva that Satan was able to throw in them because they looked at the Shekhinah originally. That gaiva was able to kill them. But not only that, much, much better answer. A much, much better answer. Shli Yayin. They drunk wine. Where'd they get this wine from? Where'd they get wine from? They couldn't have gotten wine from anywhere. Could they have? Why do you drink wine? You drink wine when what?
Shabbos.
Well, what does the Gemara Yuma say? Gemara Yuma says the only reason why you drink wine is to forget about Avelus, about mourning. They knew somebody was going to die. They knew somebody was going to die. Everybody knew the Krovaya Kodesh. They assumed it was Moshe. You know the whole thing that they said, when will these guys die so that we become in charge? What they said was, Chas v'Shalom, that we're walking around behind Moshe and Aaron saying, like, jeez, these guys, how old is he now? 80? Get him down. Like, we don't love this guy anymore. Like, they weren't saying that. Chas v'Shalom was saying such a thing. What they were doing is they were saying, let's build the Mishkan. Let's make the Mishkan work. But they knew that if the Mishkan went up, what was going to happen? Somebody was going to die. The Shtui Yain was, they were still a little bit upset. They were a little bit saddened. Sad. Why were they sad? Because they knew somebody was going to die by this action, that they were going to bring about the fire. And maybe that was the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu was delaying, because he didn't want I'm sure he would have allowed himself to die, but he didn't want Aaron to die. He wanted to make sure that it would be perfect and a perfect time where at least where the age came down and somebody would be consumed, somebody would die, it wouldn't be somebody who everybody in Bnei Yisrael would be upset about. Whatever, he took care of that. There's a lot more to this.
So they actually drink wine? Or just,
it wasn't literally wine. It was the Avelus that we're talking about. And they said, Bonim, that's also part of the guy that they refused to marry any woman. Oh, that's okay.
Wait, but Avelus makes you sad.
Avelus makes you sad, and the wine is supposed to forget about it. So they were on the level of Shtuya Yain, of people who should have been Shtuya Yain. And they were on the level of somebody who was a little bit upset, something in their head, something that was missing a little bit.
Could you say it was the Shekhinah that they got from Har Sinai, that was the Hanad
Shtuya Yain? Very good. That was the first answer, really. The first answer really goes with that more, as opposed to the second answer.
Could you say that it was destined for them to die when they started the Shekhinah? They had to wait for the incarnation, so why did they have to do the whole fire thing? Why couldn't Hashem kill them before that happened?
Oh, if only.
I'm just saying.
That's a good question. I can't answer that question right now.
It sounds like they didn't do it.
It's what to be answered. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have taken care of it in a different way. But, alright. We're skipping over to the Chazir. What is the deal? Says the Ksam Sofer, and I'm not so sure anybody else but the Ksam Sofer can say such a thing. If not for Nadav and Aviv dying, the Chazir would have been kosher. Anybody else see the connection over here?
No.
Anybody see the connection? Dude, the real chat is supposed to be that this is the time of loss of love. This is going to be the times. This is going to be the future times of where everything's good. That everything's going to be perfectly fine. If none of you wouldn't have sinned, the Mishkan would have been the third base of Mikdash. Everything would have come down. Everything would have been perfect. They would have entered Eretz Yisrael and everything would have been perfect. Because none of you sinned, all of a sudden they got knocked down. And we know there wasn't really a sin. But really, if there wouldn't have been Nenemi Ziva Shechina at Har Sinai, everything would have been okay. It's such a tremendous thing.
It makes sense.
Say, why?
Because the Chazir is psulim on the inside.
Oh,
there's on the inside.
Did you hear that? Because the chazir psul is only on the inside. Let's talk about the chazir for a little bit. There is a pasuk in this week's parsha, and that's why we go with chazir right after we talk about all this. We go into the chazir. Listen to this pasuk. The pasuk says, "The es hachazir ki mafris parsa hu." It does have split hoof. The shosas shesa parsa, and within that hoof, it is totally split right down the middle. Hu geira lo yigor, but it does not chew its cud. Tummy Ulechem, it's going to be tummy for you. Gera lo yigor is written in a future tense. Gera lo yigor, it will not chew its cud. Says the Or HaChaim, an unbelievable diak, if it would chew its cud, it would be kosher. It doesn't say vu gera lo gor, it says vu gera lo yigor. When it doesn't chew its cud, then it's not kosher. If it chews its cud, it's going to be kosher. This is an unbelievable Torah on all this. First of all, there's a Medrash in Tehillim. Kuf Mem Vav Dalet. You guys should know this pasuk in Tehillim. Hashem Matir Asurim. It's in the Halalukas. Matir Asurim. Says the Medrash on that pasuk, Hashem Matir Asurim, he's going to release the bound. The bound is any animal that's tummy in Olam Hazeh will be Tahor in Olam Haba. Then when the times of Mashiach come, all those animals are all going to be Tahor. They're all going to be Mutter. Menachem Mendel Miriminov says the pshat behind this pasuk, I don't normally go into the Hasidic things on this, but Menachem Mendel Miriminov says that the pshat behind that is that the reason why is because the only reason why there's tummy animals now is because when Adam Rishon sinned, bad sparks of Kedusha went throughout the world, and
And in order to raise those sparks to a certain level, you have to be a tremendously high person. You have to be a person on a very, very high level. So to eat those animals will actually bring you down, because the tuma that got thrown out when Nanda Marishan sinned is put inside those animals, trapped within a Nitzos HaKadosh, within a holy spark. So if you would eat that spark, you're going to be surrounded by tuma, and you're going to go down because of it. Only on the level of Olam Haba, when we get to the level where we're extremely holy, then we'll be able to eat it and not be affected by the tuma that's surrounding it. That's the reason behind it. But regardless, Shemat Terasurim, that everything's going to be fine. Most say that it's metaphorical. But there's a ritva in Kiddushin on Daf Mem Testament Beis. It's also mentioned by the Reikanti in this week's Parsha. It's also mentioned by the Rabbeinu Bachaya in this week's Parsha. And the Yafei Tor and the Medrash. The Rabbeinu Bachaya, the Reikanti, and the ritva all take it metaphorically. But it says, the Chazir, will be Chozer to us, lost in love. The reason why it's called a king is because it's going to be chosen to us. It's going to return to us in the future. And it's going to be mutter for us to eat, and we're going to be able to eat it, and everything's going to be all good with the thing. The thing is going to be perfectly fine. Everybody says it's metaphorical, refers to Edom, that in the end America is going to be on our side, that they're going to be fighting for us, and we're going to be going up against Ishmael. That's how everybody takes it. Seems like the Ritva tries to say that. I haven't taken the Ritva, not that way. But it seems that's what the Ritva says, the Reikanti, and everybody says it's referring to Edom. Yafei Toar, he said, perish on the Medrash, says straight out it's literal, that the pig is going to change. But he says, I don't get it. How is it going to be possible to go against the Torah like this? Says the Or HaChaim, it's not going against the Torah. Huger lo yigor. As long as it doesn't chew its cud, then it's bad. But if it does chew its cud, then it's going to be good. The only question is, okay, so you got to find me a pig that chews its cud. So I found one. 1986, there was a report that went out about this Babirusa. It stemmed based on a scientific report that was written in Lincoln Park Zoo back in the 1920s. They had a Babirusa. Unfortunately, I do not have a picture of a Babirusa in this thing over here. I do have pictures of a lot of other things, but I don't have a picture of the Babirusa. But I do have something that's extremely similar. So I'm going to show you guys the warthog, and I'm going to have to make you imagine. It's as if... Here we go. That's a camel. That's a pig. Okay. It's this. The difference between a Babirusa and a regular warthog is, you see those little horns right over there? A Babirusa has four horns. One, two, one, two. And they intertwine with each other like that. They look like that. That's a Babirusa. They're extremely rare. They live in Indonesia, like around this area, right around here, around Malaysia and everything like that. They're very, very interesting creatures. Very, very strange, strange creatures. But they are wild pigs. The Babirusa was dissected after it died in Lincoln Park Zoo and was found to have a multiple layered stomach. Now, in order to chew your cud, you have to have multi stomachs. You have to have not just one stomach, but you have to have at least three or four. You have to have a bunch of stomachs in order for the food to go in, then be able to regurgitate it, go back down, go into the second part of the stomach, then go up, go into the third part. To be able to regurgitate it, it has to go into different parts. You have to have different compartments within that stomach in order to be a true ruminant, to be a chewing, in order to chew your cud, in order to chew the cud. The Babirusa was found to have three stomachs, three full stomachs. So they said, must be, they chew their cud. So they started checking the Babirusa, and it doesn't chew its cud. You have a stupid, obstinate pig that has the ability to be kosher, that has the ability to chew its cud, that has all the necessary ingredients, it has the stomachs, it has everything there. It's ready to chew its cud, and it won't do it. It won't do it. You have a full pig that's going to be kosher, lost in love. It's just not doing it. When it does, it'll be kosher. And that's the fulfillment of this medrash. And within the Orach Chaim, the pshat behind the pasuk, that's the idea behind what it's going to be. There's a lot more to it. Talmid Hagim talks about it a little bit in Siman Sadi Dalet, and it's brought up in halachic controversies nowadays. It's a book that they have in Yeshurun. I found it in there. It's on page 46, I think. And I tried looking it up. I was going to bring it over here and show everybody. They've got a whole big thing on it and whether or not things can possibly be kosher. It's called halacha controversies in halacha. There's something in halacha. I forgot what it's called. Contemporary problems in halacha or something like that. Okay. I forgot what it's called.
What? But I haven't.
Yeah. I think Andy did, by the way. Yeah. You know, it's like different colors.
Yeah, I see it.
Yellow and purple. They look great on your shelves. Look beautiful on your shelves. So either way, they're in different. This is in volume 3. I think it's on page 46 around there. Somewhere around there. It's just an unbelievable piece. I forgot to look it all up because he's got a ton more in Marna Komos. Crazy other Marna Komos, and he's also got all the science behind it. So he goes through the entire thing. But that's basically over here. It's also a steak chametz if anybody wants to see it. Marecha's Gimel Sinan Zayin. Yeah.
Is the pig mentioned physically? Is that the reason why, like, modern day stuff is like a lot of it's made out of pig, like bacon. Like saying like I feel like the majority of things in America that aren't kosher are made out of pig.
Because they think
is that majority?
Not a majority, but like saying, like big things are made out of pig.
The ones that we most associate
going to eat it
because it tastes good.
Well,
I mean, obviously,
also,
like they wanted you rats, but it just didn't work out well. I think that's the obvious answer. I'm going to go into.
But why is it that it's so rare? If we're all going to have to eat it later.
Sorry?
If we're all going to eat it later, why is it so rare that like it's hard to find?
It's not going to be that way. It's going to be, we're going to be able to reproduce them. And we're going to find a way for all the pigs to be able to be that way. I mean, with genetic science, it's not that hard. You can for sure make pigs with multiple stomachs. It's very easy to do. So the question is that Q-Lime or not? Chickens, you should know 95% of chickens nowadays have rat DNA within them. Rat DNA. Because in order for them to reproduce quickly and rapidly, so they have more eggs per day, they inject rat venom within the eggs so the chickens will be able, it's funny, right? But it was a whole big question if chickens nowadays are kosher, because they kept doing the test. One of the tests that you do to check if chickens are kosher, rat DNA within the chicken eggs. But one of the ways to check if a bird is kosher is it has to have four fingers like this on the bottom of its foot. You put a string down, and if it puts its fingers down like that, 3 and 1, it's kosher. If it goes 2 and 2, it's not kosher. So longhorn chickens, where almost all of our eggs come from longhorn chickens. They started doing tests on the longhorn chickens, which have this rat DNA within them, and they all were doing 2 and 2, 2 and 2, 2 and 2. It's a whole big machlokas. So can we trust that and say, like, now they're like rats and they're puzzle, they're not chickens anymore? Or do we say, no, they're still chickens, they just got a little bit of rat DNA and they had a lot more babies, that's it. So which one is it? It's a big machlokas, but we eat them, so it's all good. Eggs could have been really about 10 years ago, I think. About 10 years ago, I think that's when it really came up and somebody came in and they're like, they're injecting rat DNA with them now. Like somebody like actually went to Revel Yash and Revel Yash is like, oh man, again. Problems, you know? All right, anyway, at the very, very end.
Inventive new ways to make life hard.
Yeah, I don't see why not. All right, we got three animals over here. We have a gamal, we have a shuffon, and we have an arnebis. So loosely translated, it's a camel, hyrax, and a rabbit. Hyrax and a rabbit. So we got problems. Because if we're talking about a camel, the hare and the hyrax, which is Slifkin's old book that got put into Cherem, so I'm going to be very careful about what I'm saying over here. If we're talking about the camel, the hare, and the hyrax, it's very hard to understand what we mean by they're chewing their cud, but they don't have split hooves. Because we're going to see there's going to be a little bit of a problem. Number one, camels. Oh, this is hyrax. You guys will get to that in a second. But camels. These are going to be a little bit easier to go through. Everybody knows there's two different types of camels, dromedaries and Bactrian. Dromedaries have one hump, Bactrians have two humps. They're very different from one another. Bactrians live in Mongolia. You won't see them too often. Dromedaries live all around Saudi Arabia. They live in the desert. The ones that you hear all the stories about traveling 45 million years without getting any water, that's dromedaries. Bactrians will actually kill you if you come anywhere near them. And they're very dangerous creatures. They have them in Lincoln Park Zoo. Go feel free. Anyway, there's Bactrian and dromedary camels. But there's other camels. They live in South America. They're known as llamas. Llamas, alpacas, vicunas, and guanacos are four different types of animals, which obviously do not have any humps whatsoever. But if you look at them, they look like a camel without a hump. They look exactly like a camel. Can they reproduce with camels? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. They have produced one. It's called a kama. It was with artificial insemination. They weren't able to make a camel and a llama with one another. They could only make it through another way. So are they from the same family? Are they considered the gama? Or is it another creature altogether? Because they have the exact same ruminancy, meaning they chew their cud just like camels do. So are they the exact same thing or not? It's a good question. According to what the Torah classifies as an animal as a gamal, mistama is considered the same thing. Now you could answer, as Slifkin does, that they're found in South America. And the Torah doesn't care about animals that are in South America. Because what do we care? We're never going to see them for another, we're not going to see them for another 2,200 years. So what difference does it make? Why should we care about them? I think that's not true. So let's not deal with that right now. But forget about it. We're talking about that mistama, camels will include llamas, guanacos, vicunas, alpacas. It'll all be considered within the gamal. You want to use an S over here, go ahead and use the S. Use the S for whatever you want. But it is considered, I would consider them all in one category because they all are considered the same type of animal. Even though they don't look exactly alike, you'll consider the dromedary and the Bactrian the same type of camel. If they're one-humped and two-humped, they're the same type. So what about these guys? Mistama, they're all the same thing. It's just a general name for a lot of things. cameloids, we'll call them. Cameloids, because that's the scientific name for them. They're all cameloids. That's all good. Chefon,
you have an animal called the hyrax. This hyrax, what does this look like to you?
Beaver.
A beaver. A big rat, right? It looks kind of big, right? They're tiny. This is about life size. This is about the size you'll see. If you ever go to Ain Gedi, you will see hundreds of these little rock hyraxes all over the place. They're all over the place. The rock hyraxes, they're everywhere. They're a little annoying. This is about how big they are. You can see they're absolutely tiny. The rock hyraxes. They're closely related to the elephant. They have nothing to do with rats or rabbits or anything like that. They're closely related to the elephant. You could say everything within them, their stomach, their lungs, everything is exactly like an elephant, except much, much, much smaller. Question is, do they chew their cud? So, some say yes, some say no, which means scientists are idiots. You have absolutely no way of telling. Depends on how you translate the word ruminancy. Totally depends on how you translate that word. If you translate it as chewing your cud like a cow, then it doesn't chew its cud like a cow. Does it chew every time it eats something? Yes, it chews every time it eats something. Does it throw it up? Sort of. Yeah, sort of. They call it mericism. M-E-R-Y-C-I-S-M. Do they know what mericism is? No. You look at any website, try to check up what mericism is, they'll give you a different translation in every website. Because nobody really knows what this stuff is. So what are hyraxes? Do they chew their cud or not? Yes. Yes. Is it substantially proven by what we see nowadays? No. Do I care? No. No. That shouldn't matter to anybody here. Because the fact is...
The tourist definition, the not the science definition.
Yes, yes, yes. And besides that, the big proof that they give that hyraxes don't chew their cud is because they're so small. They're so tiny. It makes no sense for a creature that tiny to chew their cud. Because in order to chew your cud, you have to have a lot, you have to have a big stomach. You have to have multiple stomachs, and you have to be able to, you know, go through one stomach to the other, and you have to have a low acidic content in your stomach, so when you throw up, it doesn't taste like acid every time you throw up. If it tastes like acid every time you throw up, you'd rather starve than ruminate. It just would make more sense, right? Well, that's the problem. But are they considered shuffon in our Torah, which says that they ruminate? So I will show you a little creature that is known as a chevrotain. Chevrotain is a tiny little deer. I went to the Central Park Zoo in New York just to see a chevrotain. You know how big these guys are? They're rats. They're about the size of a big rat. They're about this tall, this large. I even went down. There was nobody else around me. So I figured, what in the world? Why not? I went down there to go check it out. You can't really jump the fence. It was a very, very small fence. But I went to go check it out. The guy was absolutely tiny. Literally the size of maybe this book. Absolutely tiny. That's the normal size of the chevrotain. He definitely chews his cud. Aye, but he's a small creature. You see, it doesn't make a difference if they're small. They can still chew their cud. It's the most ridiculous argument I've ever heard before in my life. I wish I could slap these scientists in the face. Anyway, hyraxes definitely chew their cud. I'm not worrying about anything else. Arnevis, the rabbit. That's a major problem. There is no known rabbit that chews its cud. If you look at any rabbit, they do chew all the time. But they're not chewing their cud. They practice something called saccotrophy. Now, it's not like capography, where you're eating your own doo-doo. That's what rats do. That's what dogs do. That's disgusting. Saccotrophy is a little bit less sick. They have little pellets that they... Think of it as like a calcium hole, something like that. And they go to the bathroom through that area. Some of it is bathroom. Some of it are these calcium balls. And they eat those calcium balls and they chew them up. And it's like chewing gum. It's chewing. And they chew that all day long. So it's stuff that they eat. They do eat grass and plants and everything like that. They chew it up. They make it into those little tiny things. And those tiny things they eat, and that's what they're chewing. It's called saccotrophy. So if you want to say that that's called ruminating, and the Arnevis is referring to a rabbit, you got a massive problem. Because they're not the only creatures that do that. There is something called a capybara. Capybara is a rather large rat that live in South America. Do the exact same thing. They don't look anything like rabbits. I would hope not. They don't look anything like rabbits whatsoever. And that would be another thing that would have to be put into the Torah if you're going to say that the Torah is giving an exclusive list of all the things that ruminate that don't have to be like the Ramban says. So it's kind of hard to say it's an Arnevis. Aryeh Kaplan tries to answer it up by saying
There's something called an Angora rabbit that only goes to, it only throws up in the morning after it sleeps. It sleeps, throws up, and then eats it later on that day. And that's how it is able to survive the entire winter. It's really weird because it's not mentioned by anybody else. It's only mentioned by Arya Kaplan in the Living Torah. You'll find it there, but you won't find it anywhere else. It's a very, very hard thing to say to be able to say we got in that rabbit.
But I mean, anywhere else in science
I have,
books.
Anywhere else in science books. I'm not saying it's not the rabbit. It could be the rabbit, and it could be a non-exclusive list. But to help out the Ramban over here, because I like the Ramban, and I think when the Ramban says it's an exclusive list, and there are no other animals in the world that have this trait, and we mentioned that there's an hyrax, and we mentioned there's camels, and camels include llamas and everything, and now we're down to one creature, and we got to find that one creature, I got something for you. And I was told by Rabbi Schwartz that there's a new book coming out by someone in New York that says the exact same thing that I did. Have you ever pictured a giant rabbit? What would it look like? Kangaroo, right? Kangaroos are giant rabbits. Absolute giant rabbits. Guess what? They do chew their cud. Not exactly in the way that we chew their cud, that we see like animals like cows and goats and sheep chew their cud, but they practice meristem, which is the same thing as hyraxes do. Seems to be the exact same thing. Kangaroos are giant rabbits. That could be the rabbit that chews its cud, but doesn't have split hooves, obviously. It has one long foot, but it's like a rabbit. It looks exactly like a rabbit.
What? Australia's not much of a rabbit.
Australia is also, we don't care about animals in Australia. That's what he says. We don't care about kangaroos. The problem with a kangaroo is that it seems to be very similar to a koala bear, which might also chew its cud. But it's never been proven. I'm good right now. So right now, yeah. So the koala bear is a big problem. But, oh, whatever. But the kangaroo happens to be a ruminating creature. It seems to work out very well. So if somebody asks you this week, what is the shuffle that just happens to be? If you happen to get in, and, you know, get in the car and somebody says to you, so what are the three animals that are mentioned that chew their cud? Don't have split hooves. The gummel are cameloids, including the llamas, alpacas, vicunas, and guanacos. Most of our wool comes from them, by the way. And then, if they say the shafan, they say the hyrax, the rock hyrax, which is common throughout all of Eretz Yisrael. And if they tell you, ah, but they can't chew their cud because they're too small, say, there's the shafan taint, you're all good. Then, after that, if you say, what's their nevis? There are no rabbits. Then you say, well, there's the kangaroo. And then once they get so shocked, and they sit there, and they're like, what? Then you say to them, the kangaroo also chews its cud. Is that proven? Yes. Don't even bring up the koala bear, and you're all good. So why would they know that they all know? I happen to have brought that up, by the way. I wrote to Slifkin, and I asked him if the kangaroo was a good call, because the kangaroo also happens to be extremely similar. So can we include the kangaroo as the Arnebis instead of adding in the rabbits and saying that we got this other thing called psychotrophy? Why not just add in kangaroos? And it's all good. So why not just say that? So he said, what was his line exactly? He said, it's a ridiculous theory. I think that's his line. So I know I'm right now. I think that proves me even more so. So I'm very, very happy. That was the only line he wrote me. Oh, well, there were other things that I wrote. I also wrote, oh, whatever. There were a lot of things that I had problems with in this book.
Why can't you even hear the rabbit and the kangaroo? I just don't understand the ear shape. Like, one's a marsupial, one's like that.
Definitely. I'm not going to answer. Yeah, is a dingo a dog?
I don't know.
Dingo is also technically a marsupial. There are about 85 different types of marsupials.
Wallaby.
Yeah. What about the tetons?
Yes. Oh, damn, we got an Australian over here. That's right.
What about
you got all these guys. All right, we're going to stop with this.